Okay, everybody, take your seats and welcome to the first totally off-the-cuff, extemporaneous, unrehearsed course on the history of the Permanent Fund. Please sign up if you haven't back there. We have a full class. But we put this together with some intent of raising the awareness of how the Permanent Fund came into existence, because I felt personally that a lot of the younger generation doesn't know the history and needs to be reminded, and that it isn't what is generally perceived to be the history. There is another history that gets lost in the fury and the avaricious nature of having the Permanent Fund dividend. So the first two of these course meetings is going to be about the history of the fund itself, and the second two I've tried to focus on the dividend to show the relationship and clarify the distinctions between the two. That said, I also kind of preempted my helpers, Judy's role in this, but we will be recording this for its oral history at the university, and this is our recording here. Leslie is going to do that. And so if you ask questions, please speak up, and we'll try and make our voices heard as well. But we have to get a release from you. You know this whole game that is now a rather tight system to keep you from suing the university. So anyway, we were very privileged. When I talked about having this course, I spoke to it with a group of guys I meet with at lunch on Monday, and good old Carl Minetti said, gee, if you're going to do a course on the history of the Permanent Fund, why don't you just call Steve Cooper? And I said, well, I said, geez, that's a great idea. And I kind of knew Steve from several instances, and I called him up, and he said, yes, this is important. We need to do this. And there is no person I am aware of in the political establishment of Alaska and history of Alaska that is better placed now, other than those deceased, of course, which we can't call on, but he has been there from the beginning, and we're going to try and get as much out of him in this hour and 15 minutes as we can. So without further ado, I welcome Steve Cooper, and we should start the... Oh, yes, please turn off your cell phones. That would be enormously helpful. Cell phone disarmament is always an issue in the world today. I'll do the same. It's always embarrassing if the narrator's phone goes off. So anyway, has the recording started?
Started.
Okay.
Okay. In deference to my metal knee, I'm not going to stand up. If you have to strain to hear, let me know. This actually happened to me, you know, apropos of what you just said, talking about it. Cell phone. I was making a talk to somebody or other, and it was severely limited. You know, there was, you know, 2.9 minutes or some kind of thing there, and so I had the cell phone there. You know, so I could tell what time it was because I can't wear a wristwatch. And sure enough, you know, I'm talking, and the phone went off. I said I couldn't figure out what else to do. You know, so I said yes, and they said, your fly is open.
And that is Steve Cooper. That is Steve Cooper all the way. Listen, before we get too far adrift here, I wanted to start. You have all been given the World Bank paper. That it's in the list of the homework assignment that I put on the web for this class. And it is a really, really interesting reflection of Steve's progress through the state, his a little bit of biographical history. But I'm going to ask him to just sort of introduce himself and give us a little of that history, timeline, chronology, and get into the thick of what he advises now would be a strategy for using the Permanent Fund model, but not completely. So,
well, okay. I will do that. It's interesting to come back and be a genuine historic artifact. do that. You know, when I left left Anchorage looking for work, you know, going down, went to Texas. I did. I got work, but it was in West Africa. You know, they took one look at me and said, "No, you go to Africa." So anyway, that kind of ginned up into a World Bank thing, and they asked me to write a paper for that. There would be a chapter in a World Bank book, and I said, "Well, all right," you know. And I looked around and at the other people that were writing, and there was the former Secretary of the Treasury, Larry Summers, and I thought, "Well, what am I doing here?" But anyway, the thing got put together and published and everything, and the editors were in London, and so they read this copy, and it was kind of a historical account of the permanent fund and the dividend and all that, liberally sprinkled with opinions, they looked at that and they said, "Juno, we've never heard of Juno. Juno can't be the capital of Alaska. It must be Anchorage." So they put it in there, you know. And I thought, well, that guy's been trying to move the capital to Anchorage for years. And here this guy's done it. He's thousands of miles away. Anyway, yeah, I mean, basically, it's a history lesson. And whether it's a lesson or not remains to be seen. But here we are with a back story, which is... everybody in this room for sure has got some idea of the unique importance of state government. A lot of you go all the way back like I do where, I mean, the 900 million came sailing out and people, that was when the state's budget was like, I mean, the general fund, not the federal, $121 million. You know, we spend that in an instant now, and this is $900 million, and it was advance payment for a lease, and Keith Miller had a big ceremony there, and they, you know, brought the money out and they showed everybody the money and everything, and the deal was that. The pipeline didn't get started until about 1974, and it didn't get finished until 1977. Well, by 1974, they'd snapped up all the money. It was gone. And in 1974, that's when they had a kind of a little mini revolution in Juneau down there, and it was also... incidentally, the same year as the Watergate, so the Democrats kind of had the advantage for a moment there. and people got elected, and they said, "He got elected? What?" And it would be somebody's son, you know, that they'd known. He just not too long ago, he'd been delivering papers to him, and now he's in the legislature. And we had about eight people, or nine, maybe something like that, that were in their 20s. And there was a generous leavening of older people, like, you know, 40. and I'll tell you what, the Anchorage Times, Atwood, who was that guy that was the, you know?
Tobin,
yeah. Boy, he hated it every minute. He saw all his kind of children showing up there, and he knew that was going to, things were going to go bad. but anyway, this is the legislature elected in 1974 and served in office 1975 and 1976. It was the most remarkable experience of my life. I will never forget it. We came in there, and I asked Mike Bradner, who was the speaker, he was from here, And I said, Mike, somebody told me to be on the finance committee because you can't get anything done unless you are. So he said, well, all right. You know. And so we came in on the finance committee, and here's people about half 20, and, you know, there's some 60-ish people in a good mix in all. And,
wait. What? It was really that easy to get on the finance committee?
That's all it took.
Wow. Takes more than that today.
Well, it was helpful to have the second largest number of votes in the state.
Yeah.
Of course,
okay.
If you were in Fairbanks, you always had to, because there were six of us, you know, running at large. Mm. So we all always had to. Anyway, and so we came now. I didn't know a thing about the legislature. I'd never been there. And so I'm looking around, and I said, well, where's my office? And they said, well, you don't have an office. I said, you're on a finance committee. You don't need an office. You work all the time. You sit around this table, and that's the end of it. and nobody thought about a staff. I mean, a staff? Staff? Is he thinking of a big stick? And so here we all came in with the most important issues that would ever appear in the state of Alaska before or since. And we had no staff. We had a secretarial pool of three. And there were two staffers, one for the speaker, and because he had ruled that there would be a speaker for him. And the Rules Committee, which was run by Willard Bowman, if any of you remember Willard, and hey, how about this? That meant that all the legislators had to read the bills. And they had to read all the bills and say, well, what is that? You know, and we the legislature itself had a very able staff, particularly the finance committee. But you had to do it yourself. If you didn't understand it, there was always somebody there that would pound it into you. And that's how it worked. And we did things. Terry Gardner was 24 years old. He was chairman of the Judicial Committee. He wrote himself what was judged to be the top criminal code in America. A 24-year-old fisherman did that himself. Got a little help from the Attorney General every now and then, but these things were getting done, they were fights and the usual. And Hugh Malone he was from Kenai. He was a surveyor, Irishman, and he was the chairman of the finance committee. And very quickly, a leadership based on ability just outed. You know, you knew who was the leader. They didn't tell you, I'm the leader. You knew who it was. And we started running legislation through there that was needed by Alaska. It was a whole different world, right? I mean, some of you at least were around here in the 60s. You know how it was then. And this was completely different, Prudhoe Bay, all this money cascading in. You thought, well, what are we going to do now? And it went on till about July the 4th, and Tobin was going crazy about that and stuff. And towards the end of the session, Jim Rode, who was from Juneau, and his father was a fishing wildlife guy that got killed in a crash out at what was later the Clarence Road Wildlife Refuge, yeah, was what it was. And Jim had gone to the London School of Economics, guy from Juneau, I mean. And he came back, and he was absolutely brilliant. And he was working for Hugh Malone. And he said, look, said he says Keith Miller, when he was here, he wanted to put all that money in a trust kind of thing. And then we'd live off the income from the trust. It was kind of that simple. And Keith couldn't get the votes, and people kind of forgot about it. And Jim Rhode brings it up to Hugh Malone late in the session, says, well, we ought to do this. And we got together informally and said, well, how about this thing? It means we can't spend all the money, you know, and everybody, you know, mumbled about that. But then the money hadn't gotten there yet, you see. And so he says, let's do it. And we didn't know, that's as far as it had gone. Let's put this some kind of thing like this together. And we did, and we went to Hammond, and Hammond liked it. I mean, we were all working with Hammond. We were Democrats, but we worked with Hammond. And I don't know, you know, there's a longer story than that, believe me.
Yeah.
And it had to do with the old Democrats, but they didn't care for us. So the original thing that came out, it was a bill. And it basically said that we'll save up the money and just, you know, whenever it comes, whenever it has some income, then we can figure out what to do with that if it comes. So it was pretty. And then somebody came up and said, well, wait a minute, that's not going to work because the next legislature, they'll just get rid of the thing and take the money and spend it. And that, we went over to the Senate, and that's what they all had in mind. And, there's another piece in this. The legislature spent all the money in about 1974. And we didn't have enough money. We couldn't even get through the end of the session, and we'd run out of money. It'd be nothing. And Malone's seeing me loitering in the hall, you know. He says, you got to solve this, he says. And I'm not going to take a lot of time on that, but the only people who had any money was the oil company. I mean, nobody else had any. And, you know, there the government was about to run out of money and fall off the cliff. And so Willard Bowman and I went to the oil companies, and he well, I'll leave this out. we met with these big oil company people dressed up like major league hippies. And Willard had bones and stuff around his neck, and he's a black guy. And we didn't have any furniture in the room that the oil company guys would come to, and so they had to sit on the floor, you know. and anyway, in the end, you know, there was a bill that would kind of force them, well, no kind of about it, force them to give us a loan of the money that we needed to get tided over until 1977, which supposedly would be the day that the pipeline was finished, and that that we would pay them back over time, and there was a schedule, and there'd be no interest involved, and it seemed fair to me, you know. And, you know, they're complaining about it and stuff, and I couldn't kind of count the votes there, you know, and it turned out it needed for the oil companies to give up, you know. And so I said, all right, here's the deal. And Willard says this, actually, you know, he looked a lot meaner than I did. and Willard says, here's the thing. Says, we got a bill here that we're going to pass that where we pay you people back. And we want you to agree with that. And if we don't, we ain't going to pay you back. And they thought about that for a minute, and they said, okay. So anyway, we got all the way to 77 that way. But anyway, so Hammond basically vetoed his own bill on the permanent fund and said, we've got to make a permanent, make a constitutional amendment out of this so it'll stay in place. So we did. And we put it in, and it was a very short amendment, and I got it sitting here, and I won't bore you by reading it. At least 25% of all mineral lease rentals, royalties, royalty sale proceeds, federal mineral sharing payments and bonuses received by the state shall be placed in a permanent fund, the principal of which shall only be used for those income-producing investments specifically designated by the law. All income from the permanent fund shall be deposited in the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. That's it. That's the end of it. No 90-page wonder. There it is. That's the amendment that got us the permanent fund, and it was passed by a very large majority in the 1976 election, and there it was. And then we came back, and the legislature realized, look, we got to fill it out. You know, we got to fill out the details, and that's up to the legislature. And we authorized. You know, we realized we're not real smart in Alaska. You know, in 1976, about investing large sums of money, seeing as how nobody has any. So, you know, Hickel and Barney Gottstein and everything. But here's what we'll do. We'll authorize only the purchase of government bonds, U.S. government bonds. And everybody thought, well, that's right. Yeah, you know, a dumb person can do that. And so that's all we had. Well, that was the only time frame in history when government bonds had a 13% return. Just luck. And so next time, you know, and so 77, 78, we kind of talked about, well, we got to get this done and figure out what to do with the money and everything, and it really didn't pay much attention to it. So 78, I was gone. Goodbye. I was actually the state lobbyist for the Alaska Lands Bill in Washington. And so Hammond and the legislature says, well, look, what are we going to do with this money? And the money was starting to mount up, and people were kind of looking at it that way. So Hammond and the legislature and Jim Rode notably and Malone says, let's have us a panel of wizards, and they will tell us what to do. So they brought in a panel of wizards, and they came from all over the place, you know. They knew everything. Had these little hats and stuff. Stupid. So anyway, they studied this and all this for about a year, and they came back and they said, well, look, here's the deal. Said, we got high oil prices, and they will never go down. Ever, they said, the wizards. And actually, before too long, it'll go up to $100 a barrel, and it will never come down, the wizards said. And you will never need any of that money for government, the wizards said.
You might add that this was during the Iranian oil crisis, too.
Well, it was. It was 79.
The world political context matters here.
The 79 was the Iranian revolution, which would cause the... So they said, here's what to do. They said, give the money away. And there were various people around there saying, what? But Jim Rode liked it, and Malone liked it, and the governor liked it, and it was an excellent thing to tell people. We're going to give you free money forever. And so they, you know, that's what happened. They set this, the dividend business up, and I got to admit that I opposed it all the way. But then I was in Washington, D.C., and they didn't care what happened to me. You know, they thought that was about far enough. But anyway, that took place, and then, of course, the money began to build, and the first dividend was about...
1982.
Yeah, 82. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I remember that. I was running for governor in 1982.
And that was also the year when the income tax was eliminated.
Yeah, it was. And so things kind of bumbled on, you know. And 1986, in spite of all the things that those wizards said, oil went down to $9. And of course, I chose that time to, you know, go in there and straighten it out. That's great, great time in here. Yeah. And so what we did, this was 1986 through 90 that I was there. And by the time I got out of there, everything was okay. Hey, those wizards, they weren't so dumb after all, you know. And what had actually happened was there was another war in the Middle East, and oil prices shot up, and then we had an item called the Exxon Valdez, which hired up every available adult person, and actually some children, I noticed, to work full time for large wages, and the economy in Alaska was the best in history. And I thought, man, you know, here we are. We're saved by a war and one of the worst environmental catastrophes ever. And that's a, you know, uniquely Alaska solution.
could we back up to you? What one of the things you tried to do in your
Well, I hardly got there yet.
Well, you've moved on beyond it, though. I mean, you were in 1989 now.
So anyway. And so.
I don't want you to get too far out of here.
No, never too far out of here. Believe me. You know what? We left out the Burn Initiative.
The Burn Initiative.
Okay, that's for later. that's to give away all the land in Alaska.
In one swell swoop,
you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, towards the end of 1990, we created the budget reserve, which was a new animal, and it was towards the end of the session, and Mary Halloran, who was a very able staffer of mine, and we just kind of wrote it out on yellow paper, you know, and told the Attorney General's office, you better copy that or else. Because they did not like us, the lawyers I'm talking about. And so we put this budget together, budget reserve together, that would mean that the state's revenues wouldn't do this on you, you know, every week, every year. And when it went up, they spent all the money. When it went down, they didn't have any money. So it was kind of dumb. So this got rid of that problem. And we went and asked some legislators, oh, no, we don't want to do that. We said, well, let's, you know, let the people vote on it. Well, no, we ain't going to let them vote on it. So in the right at the end of the legislature, we just reared back and fired it at them. And they had to do it real quick, and they didn't read it, and they didn't know what it was. And we had some people going through there, just vote, trust me, vote, vote, vote. And then it was a couple of guys. One guy from Kenai, I remember, he needed a bridge. And he was not going to vote for it unless he had that bridge. And I said, hey, get him that bridge, man. And there's a Funny River Bridge was what it was. And there were a couple of little items like that, you know, that's what you do. Probably sounds evil, but you know what? Makes it all work. It's like grease. And so that got in there, and actually that helped quite a bit. That's the reason we're not broke today, that little item. So I tried to get essentially a permanent fund for the school system done. And you need a two-thirds vote. That was a constitutional deal, too, for all the same reasons. You know, you wanted to be there the year after you left. A Democrat whose name I recall vividly told me, oh, absolutely, I'm going to vote for that governor. You can count on me. And he lied. And he was the one vote that caused it to go down, and that's why you don't have a permanent fund for the school system.
And are you going to disclose that person's name?
No, I'm not. I'm waiting for
him.
Whoa, we
can.
I'm laying
that
for him. That's
on state record, so.
That is.
It is. Yes, it is. I don't do forgiveness.
Now, you're our guy.
Do it. Well, let me. So here we are, okay? And they, people have been, you know the story. I'm not going back over it. I mean, people get $2,000 or $3,000, well, $1,000 or $2,000 or somewhere in there a year, and that's what people have come to expect. And you know what? It's done a lot for the state. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. It has particularly helped rural Alaska, particularly, which is a place that I really value. But what it means is that the purpose that the people who actually created the permanent fund were looking for was to have enough money left over when the oil went to run the government and have low taxes. That's what we thought we were going to get. But things are never like you planned it, you know. And now it's an entitlement. And by the way, to throw this in, I was in Santa Barbara, California one time in a bar, believe it or not. I had my sister live there at the time and some other people. And there were people boasting in the next booth about all the money that they had been sent by the Alaska Permanent Fund, and they had never even been there.
Oh my.
And they were laughing about it. Those dumb, you know, there's a word. They said about us, and you know, I knew this was going on. So did anybody. If you got an address for permanent fund dividend recipients, and it's a post office box, and there are 32 people in there, you need to find out where the damn house is and break in. But no. We put a bill in there to do that, and I got to be partisan here. And every Republican said no. No. It's like, it's almost like, we like those crooks. And it's still there. And we had somebody look at that, and you know, the 32 people in the same house, it kind of suggests, there's enough of that going on so that the estimate is 10% of that money is going to criminals. And nobody is doing a thing about it and ever has done a thing about it. So that's something to think about, too. You know, when you're sitting here trying to figure out how to keep the schools open. So here we are. And Bill Walker's got it. Let me tell you something. if Alaska had to invent a governor to be there when this is happening, that's the guy.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's the guy.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. He's doing the best for Alaska. He's honest. He's honorable. And he's down to earth, you know? He's not yelling about political philosophy.
And he's being sued for what he did.
That's right. That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
So in the middle of this, Alaska's got to have a government. You know, you got to have a government. Alaska, I mean, Texas would work fine without a government. Near as I can tell, they don't do anything. Yeah.
But that's what's happening here. Yes.
But you can't have an Alaska without a decent government, state government. It's the only state in the Union that's not completely enveloped by counties. That tells you something. And we all know that in a place like this where the climate is, well, actually, I started to comment on the climate, but you don't know what it is, you know.
Wow.
Well, it used to be anyway. but the state government really is the backbone for the whole state. And there are lots of people in the state and a lot of people in bars, you know, and doing this. And I don't mind, you know, I go to bars a lot, actually. You know. But that will say, we don't need a government, you know, we're out here by ourselves in the wilderness and all that kind of stuff. They say that kind of stuff in Anchorage. Look, you know, every now and then I hear somebody say, we don't need a government, anything, something like that. And I think, I know a couple of places that you need to go. One of them is Somalia.
I knew you were going to say that.
Where you can carry your guns.
Yeah.
And you better.
Yeah. Yes. There's a longer story about that, but I'll leave it be. I was almost the oil and gas advisor for Somalia. And the other guy and I, there was a guy who claimed he was president. The problem was he wasn't in Somalia. He was in Nairobi. Easy, right? So he made us big papers with ribbons and wax and all multicolored stuff. And he calls Bill Bromo up and he says, that's my partner. And Bill grew up in Ethiopia and been in Africa for 47 years. And he said, I want you to meet me at the Mogadishu airport. He said, last I saw the Mogadishu airport, you couldn't land an airplane there. It had big old craters and stuff. And you could get a small helicopter maybe in between the craters, but that was about it. And he said, no, he says, we got a secret airfield in northern Kenya, which, of course, I knew about, and so did Bill. You know, that's how secret it was. And we're going to fly. This is the truth. It's in writing. We're going to fly you guys over to the Mogadishu airport, and you're going to jump out in parachutes. And at the time, Bill Brumbaugh was about 65, and I was over 70. And they were going to have us jump out. Well, anyway. So, but you get the idea. Here we are. And the truth is that oil and gas in Alaska, in future, the production of is quite limited. I do know quite a bit about that because I've been working in that sector for a long time. And so without going into detail, which of course I will and at the drop of a hat, but trust me on this, it's not going back to $100. It is not happening. Secondly, the LNG market in Asia is very dicey. And that gas line is going to need more than luck to get itself built. And let me just leave it off at that. So all the solutions, it's going back to, let's just sit here, it'll go back to 100 by next week. No, ain't happening. Let's just sit here and the gas line will come by and then we'll be rich again. No, ain't happening. So you got an income tax, which people won't do, and you've got a legislature that won't do anything. You do. Mm-hmm. And there are people that need to be to be brought to heel on that. I don't know. I think Benny Dagiak's the only legislator I know anymore. I was up here not too long ago and watched it. He's looking at his watch thinking,
no.
Time for you to get out. You know, but I watched a TV thing up here not too long ago. I was in somebody's cabin up there, and there's a guy named who I don't know there, named Peter McKicky. He's a legislator from, or maybe he's a senator.
He's a senator, yes.
From Nikiski.
Yes.
And everything he said made sense. He was good. He comes right out of the industry. You know, people can't be in the legislature. Well, why not? It's your main, you know, it's your main industry. Why not have a legislator from there, or two or three? And everything that he was saying was against his own political interests. But he knew what had to be done. And I thought, we could use several of those. And you know, I'm sure there are others. There are, particularly in the state Senate. But whatever's happening, legislature has to fix it. It has to be the legislature. If the governor can't fix it, he did his best. I mean, and everybody else is sitting and watching, and the legislature has to do it. And we have got about enough money in the budget reserve, probably to last possibly as long as 2 years. So, you know, everybody can skate for a while. But then when you do, there's not any money left in the budget reserve. And so let me tell you, that legislature is playing with fire. That's what's happening. And, you know, I mean, I've been sitting in Texas since 2001, but I'm still here. You know, it's like a Willie Nelson song I know called The Highwayman. You know, everybody wants to go back to where they think their home is, and this is it, this town. And so, anyway, I guess that's where to leave it, because that's where it is. It has to be fixed. It has to be done by the legislature. And you have to use permanent fund earnings. You have to do it. You have to use it all, but you do. You have to do it, because you can't get it anyplace else. And originally, it was meant for this very purpose, by the people who created the permanent fund. So,
can you get on the KFAR and talk to that segment of the population that doesn't want to hear anything? I mean, here you're preaching to the choir.
I know. I know. I hadn't seen a shoe coming through.
Yes.
But I think that would be a good venue for this.
Well, let me just say that we're trying to get on Talk of Alaska next Tuesday. I haven't secured that yet, but it looks very, very positive.
It's still a skewed audience.
Well, sure, it's a skewed audience, but at least it's statewide.
Yeah.
And frankly, you know, I it's my fault that we didn't do this. I'm filling up his time as it is. But somebody told me to go on with Steve Floyd and prep for Steve to come. We're having two more events with Steve. One is tomorrow night at the Borough Library, and they're advertising the paper. I mean, I'm hoping more and more people will come, but it's really hard to reach people, and I wanted to do it at the university so we reach the next generation. So, but you've said some marvelous things here. You use the argument here. You even recommend in your World Bank paper that we use the Sao Tome and Principe use the Alaska model, but don't use the permanent fund. Yesterday I was on the web and I found a presentation at Harvard University by the premier of Norway, Jens Stoltenberg, and he's talking about the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, and they did what we should have done. They saved everything and only used the earnings. Mm-hmm. And they have this wonderful, his presentation is just compellingly wonderful. They're one of the Gini estimate of life quality and economic health and everything else about this Norway. We all know this. We hear it all the time. Norway's this wonderful place. Well, it is. And it is because they've done it right. But in fact, they did it after we did it. And some of it, I think, they learned from us, but they did not pay their people a dividend, and they saved everything, and they still have high taxes, and they pay for the government they want, and they have a very good, mature bureaucracy, consequently. So it's a great system.
I think you kind of misstated a little bit there. Because of what we advised actually, John Tohatsky, you know who he is? He's a state economist. He was with me over there in Africa. And we recommended a permanent fund. We did. The permanent fund in Alaska was the best. Dave Rose was a person, you know, people are always talking, somebody that needs to be sainted. But that guy was a great Alaskan, and he was the one that made the permanent fund made it work like it does. They're not responsible for what happens to the earnings. They just shovel it out the door, and so we said, okay, do the permanent fund. Kind of like we did. I mean, we know you're right in the middle of Africa and everything, but do not do the dividends. And we got gaff back from the permanent fund about that. And I said, well, you people hired me to do this and to do this report, and this is it, and I ain't changing it. But yeah, and the other thing is the guy that was there before at the Norwegian fund, there was one before the guy you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Well, he and I were in London talking, making speeches to the Sovereign Wealth Fund organization, whatever it is. I mean, they gave me money to go to London. Yeah, I'm going. But the Norwegian guy who ran that fund, and it was $700 billion then. I know
it's still about $700 billion because they've had a bad year.
Well, this was six, seven years ago over there, and they asked a TV guy asked a Norwegian person who's I forgot his name. I actually knew him for a while, and they said, "You've done a great job here." Said, "Is there anything you regret not doing?" And he thought a minute and he said, "Yeah. If I had it all to do over again, I would do it just like the Alaska Permanent Fund." That's what you got down there.
Without the dividend.
Yeah, without the dividend.
Yeah.
I'm only halfway through Mr. Rose's book on the permanent fund. Was the permanent fund set up to give a dividend check to the individuals, or was it set up as a permanent fund?
No.
Permanent fund came later.
The dividend came later. See, that's part of the problem.
Is the dividend fund, dividend payout actual paperwork out there, a check on it that says we're going to give a dividend of the interest or income on the permanent fund?
Well,
am I making sense?
There's a formula based on the last 5 years of performance.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a law.
Yeah. Well, it's a law.
Legislature still has to appropriate all the earnings. That is has always been the case.
It'll always be the case. That's right.
So the legislature really has control of it, of what we do with the permanent fund earnings. It's just that they've always put half of it into the dividend.
Well. The deal is that there's a law saying that the legislature has to put it into an earnings fund.
That's right.
And that some percentage of that then gets put into a dividend fund. But that's it. It doesn't say the dividend fund goes out because they have to appropriate it out of the dividend fund. And so it's their choice. You might say that half the money goes out to people and that's it. But that's not the way it works. Not legally, you know. And after all, you know, it's supposed to be a government of laws, you know. Sometimes it's not. But that's what it is. I mean, the basket is there. And the money goes out of the general fund into this basket. And more or less half of it is supposed to go for inflation proofing, but there hadn't been any inflation for years. And the other half goes to the dividends, supposedly. But they still have to
allocate the actual check.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. They have to appropriate it. And that's what's going on. And in fact, the governor wants to put half of it on a permanent fund, or at least I think, $1,000 anyway, which is, I think, more or less half, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Well, it's about, half would be close to two. It's about
half of half.
Yeah,
it's a quarter.
It's
he wants to cut
I want to ask you two things. One idea that's become widely circulated in the last year or two or more is that, well, the dividend is the citizen's share of our collectively owned resources. And it's because at statehood we got the state got subsurface, and subsurface rights cannot go to individuals, and that's why nobody should change this at all, because it's our individual right. So anyway, I want to ask you about that idea, which Hammond to some degree spouted that kind
promoted
of stuff. Yeah. But that, I'll answer that. But there's I guess the other question is, has the dividend, Hammond also promoted this, that the dividend would protect the permanent fund, and that's the reason why we have the permanent fund, is because the existence of the dividend allowed people to keep an eye, you know, keep vigilant.
Well, there is the 1999 era when there were sieges on the permanent fund, which we should talk about, because there was an effort to cash it out. When the oil prices went down and everything looked very grim, so we took a vote and like 80% of the people said, don't even touch it.
You put an advisory vote and people read it as, should I send you less money?
Yeah.
Yes or no?
Yeah.
That's how it's translated.
Well, there's a venal interpretation, but can you argue that didn't protect the fund? I think it protected the fund.
Well,
what do you think, Steve?
Well, I don't know. I was not here at the time. And if I had been, I would have skated anyway.
What do you mean you would have skated anyway?
On the question. look.
Now you see me, now you don't.
Here's what I actually have. Jim Lode said, we've got to protect the fund, and the way to protect the fund is to give people some of it. That's where, that's exactly the words that he used, and he's always the place where you start. Because none of this originated with Malone or Hammond. And they're the three big people. I mean,
what? Malone, Hammond, and
Jim Rohde. And they were all very good friends of mine, very close friends, all three of them.
And all big dividend proponents.
Yeah, they were.
But
they were.
This question I want to know, is this the state individual right because we were denied subsurface rights at statehood?
It's not. It's not a right. People are always. You know, ginning up rights. The law is the law. The law says that the legislature has to appropriate the money. It's very suggestive, that language in there, that half of it goes to the dividend. But look, we're sitting here. What has he got? Like 20% of the money he needs for a last year's budget or something like that?
Yes.
Alaska's gone. Yeah. Poof. Yeah. Guess what? No law. I mean, this is serious, people. Yeah. You know?
That's why you're here, Steve.
It is. Yeah. You know?
That's why this course is here.
You think you can keep a university in Fairbanks open?
Nope.
Not in a flash. Nope. No. Whatever's left of it is going to Anchorage. And it's leaving Southeast, and it's leaving Bethel, and it's leaving Kenai and every place else. A little part of the place they got now in Anchorage, and that's it. How many schools are you going to keep open? Well, you have a great big school in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau. Everybody else has got to rent a boat. I mean, if you look at it, if you study it, if you've got a sense of history here, you know exactly what's going to happen. It ain't no better in the United States of America. You've heard of that.
Yeah, except we have the money. we have the ability to solve this problem.
Well, actually, you don't have the money because until somebody appropriates it, and they do, they just crank it out. Government is in bad repute everywhere. Everywhere you look, people dislike their government. They're getting more radical by the minute. And if Alaska is going to get out from under that, then people better jump on Bill Walker's bandwagon, I tell you that, because he's right. He's got it. He understands it. And this is not some weird thing here. This is a huge global problem of which we're a small part. But it's the same problem, only a little switch, because we got $55 billion in the bank. Imagine what happens if Alaska basically tanks in and he has to shut the government down to next to nothing. How many oil company families do you suppose is going to come up here if there's no university and the schools aren't around? People that work in the oil industry are going to treat it like Turkmenistan. I've been there,
too. That's a pretty good example, actually.
Been there, too. And what you've got is the ability to get out of this situation that they are looking at in the lower 48 and Europe and every place else. Russia, China's better off than most. But things are not looking good just now out there. And if you basically close down the shop down here, think just for a minute about how martial law is going to look.
Somalia.
No, but it won't happen because the federal government will send troops out here.
Yep.
That's what will happen. Chuck.
Steve, in 1980, I remember going to my tax man, probably the first time I ever went to a tax man, because I went to work for the government and had everything properly recorded and stuff for the first time. At any rate, Carl Benson looks at me and he goes, well, there is no state income tax. And I went, well, what the hell happened to it? And he said, they stampeded it out along with that permanent fund. So give me a little perspective of what happened to the state income tax, because it was not well publicized at the time, either that or I was spending too much time downtown.
Well, you were spending too much time downtown. But still, there's an answer. There's another answer. Well, basically, people are sitting, the same thing, the same wizards are there. This is 1980. All the wizards, conical hats, bats, owls.
Hogwarts.
Yeah, yes. The people from, you know,
Harry Potter.
Boston and places like that, and they're telling us what to do. And Randolph is sitting there, and Randolph says, "Well, wait a minute here." He's saying, "Let's take all this money and give it all away. What are we doing taxing with an income tax if you're going to do that?" And then they said, "Oh, yeah, we forgot about that." And so it just that's the only thought there was. Okay, what the hell? We won't miss it. Poof. And it's gone. And Jay said he put up an argument that, you know, ought to give away the earnings of the permanent fund and then tax it all back. Come on. I mean, this is a guy that's been in like 8 elections. I mean, he knows you can't do that. And I actually brought up an income tax in 1986. And 7. I actually brought it up. I never took little polls or any of that, but anyway.
After all bets were off, right?
All bets were off after I said all bets were off. It's true, too. You know, you got to admit. Somebody gives you a sack of money and says it's, you know, $600 million, and then you open it up and there's $200 million, you know. Kind of way. But yeah, I mean, people didn't, you're right, people didn't think about it. Because the wizards had said, we're so rich we don't have to think about anything like an income tax, and boom, it's gone. Forever, maybe.
Yeah. But one thing I remember is I was in Toronto at the time that the vote was taken, and Dick Randolph was interviewed by a reporter, and that reporter asked, if you take away just abolish the income tax and don't just suspend it, what are you going to do when the oil runs down? And Dick Randolph said, I don't know. I won't be around. It's not my problem.
There's a series of there's an article on the videos that I may have passed out. There's a list, I think, on the website that includes that quote. Mm-hmm. And he claims that oil won't run out for 100 years. He says, we're always going to have oil, and we just have to look hard. But he does say flat, I don't know what will happen when the oil runs out.
Well, Dick's political philosophy was not exactly a secret. He too was a good friend, mm-hmm. a personal friend. And, I mean, he was who he was.
Yeah, still is, by the way.
Yeah, of course he is.
That's true.
I appointed a libertarian to the Senate after Don Bennett died. I mean, you can't be in Fairbanks and not like libertarians.
You can't. I mean, you're lost.
Dave, yeah.
I'm curious if you've got a recipe for the next few years. How do we get back to what Alaska was good at? Bipartisan or multipartisan or nonpartisan government, a population that had an understanding of civics, the way people worked at it. They worked at getting statehood. They worked at getting the vote. I mean, the Vic Fishers, the Judge Wickershams, the people who put their whole heart and soul into making sure that there became a state government. And you say, you've got to have a state government in this state. How do we get that idea back to the people who count?
Well, that business of working together across party lines, that bird's flown the coop. I don't know. I mean, look, there is a brief, and people are already talking about it in the rest of it out there, the lower 48. How happy to say that. Be someplace I can say that. It may be that the fabled American democracy is not up to the tasks that it's being charged with now in the 21st century. The best that a bunch of very smart, remarkable people could come up with in the late 1700s just may not be the best system for the 21st century. People are thinking about that. And that's as far as it's going, but people are always talking, they're talking about very powerful executive branches, which of course I kind of like. but and also a vast reduction in the powers of legislative branches. Why is that? Because everybody hates the legislature and the Congress. Everywhere. I mean, not in, you know, places like Arizona and stuff. They they've either got bad press or anyway. But no, I think it's a very critical time in the country. And you add on top of this the wholesale murder of nature. You can blame it on whatever you want to blame it on, poachers or climate change, which is certainly happening, And all of this stuff is coming down at you at once, and you know, all those wars in the Middle East and people blowing up stuff, and you know a lot of people, you know, don't want to get up in the morning sometimes. I mean, it seems like Alaska would be a kind of an escape mechanism for that. I mean, maybe that's the future of Alaska, is retired people with money. and
might be warm enough.
Oh, it is, yeah. Palm trees, man. I mean, you just would not want to be a polar bear or a walrus or a muskox just now.
No.
They get up in the morning and something's wrong with everything.
Well, Trump's going to make it all right.
Well, he said he was. He would. You know.
Believe me.
Trust him.
Yeah. Anna?
Yeah, I think you guys are talking in really grandiose thoughts, and I appreciate where that's going, but I felt like some of our discussion and what we've been with the League of Women Voters and the speakers and everything is not hitting home and with the Alaskan electorate, and I totally agree that we need to change, and the one thing that I think that just like with the permanent fund, when it was sold, it hits you in the pocket, in your pocketbook. And the thing I want people to understand is who do they think they're going to sell their homes to in 5 years? You know, that you will not have a market to buy your home. You will not have people to buy your products because everybody will have flown the coop when Alaska goes down financially. It's not about state government and whether we can pave the roads or not, because those are all, people can't relate to those pictures, but they can say, what? I'm not going to be able to sell my home? What are you talking about? So I'm thinking, you know, we need to get some message out there to rattle those cages and get people to realize how serious this is.
It's true, it's. I mean, you don't want to come at people with a. I mean, it's hard not to, okay, but to come to them with a completely negative message, because then they think, well, I'm hearing enough of that, you know.
The sky is falling.
If there's some way, there ought to be, because I've just my opinion, and you know, maybe there's nobody that nobody else that believes this, but I think the state government and the government workers I'm talking about, I mean, maybe the ones that make decisions can be faulted for this and that, but they are good. They brought good to this state, public employees have. And you know, that's something that people never think about, you know. There's a lot of talk about bureaucrats, this and that, and everything, and but most of them I knew worked way beyond 4:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah. I wonder how many people in this room worked for you at that time, put in those extra hours, and in spite of who was governor.
That's right. Sometimes.
You know, one of the most interesting things I've heard recently was in the governor's five governors thing that's on the oral history websites and whatever. Hickel makes a point, and I've never heard anything by Hickel that I found so profoundly important. He makes the case that he compares the state operation and the state budget to Conoco and its budget. And he says Conoco has like, I don't know whether it was 20,000 or 40,000 employees for the size of the corporation it is. He says, here we are, we have $50 billion in the bank, we have a $10 billion budget. We need 20,000 people. We need the auditors. We need these people checking our income sources. We need that size of government just to operate well. How is it that we think cutting government is going to be an advantage to us? It's a very articulate, very unarguable to me point, and Hickel makes it very compellingly in that case. I just sat there and realized I had never heard him make that case. I wish I'd been in the audience when he did this. It was 1993, and it's mm-hmm. still very important to recognize mm-hmm. that if you've got an operation which requires that scale of support and administration and bureaucracy, mm-hmm. you have to support it.
Mm-hmm. A little off that subject, but back to something else you mentioned. I was an auditor. I designed systems to look efficiently at keeping the number of staff you needed to run unemployment insurance was my specialty, and Department of Labor group. And what we did was use accepted standards for quality control to take random samplings of things. And one of the quick ways to do this was using the permanent fund list. So from 84 until 2002, when I retired, we developed an examination to look at dependents' allowances that were given out, and I'm sure that the Health and Social Services also used that same list, that permanent fund list. And I've got to say, you said there was a 10% abuse rate on that list. We did not find anything near a 10% really? Abuse rate on the unemployment when we compared and looked for those dependents on that list. But each one of those families with dependents had an address there. And if that address list, if that list was ever published in the Anchorage Daily News, I swear to God, there would be an end to the permanent fund in no time flat, because the number of outside of Alaska addresses those checks were going to was shocking.
Yep.
Page after page of Eielson Air Force Base to Malcolm Air Force Base, page after page of people who intend to come back to Alaska, etc. The amounts of money leaving the state were just shocking. It reminded me, after the pipeline was over, the complaint about how much unemployment insurance was leaving the state because of all these out-of-staters who went home. And they're going, that's all of our sovereign wealth leaving Alaska. But it was stunning. Mm-hmm. That's my only comment. So you've got a very valid point about that 10%. We weren't looking for fraud on PFD, but we found a little bit.
Yes, sir.
In relation to that idea of what could you do, how could you help, and so forth, constituent meetings of the majority caucus over the last couple of years. I mean, a year and a half after the oil prices had cratered, the legislative finance director was, David Thiel, was showing this model that showed if you increase the taxes, this would happen, and if you take a portion of the earnings reserve and you know, if you keep going like you're going, he had an interactive live model and walked all the legislators through it. The majority caucus was there, and the numbers were very clear. It was readily obvious to anyone. And two sessions have now passed since that, and that's obvious that they're lying to their constituents at their constituent meetings that, oh, we can still cut government, because he had in that model a very obvious set of numbers so that anybody that could count would understand that none of that argument held water. And KFAR might be a way to reach those constituents who have grown used to hearing their legislators, several of whom are from Fairbanks, particularly two senators and one House rep. But they've been lying to their constituents that, yeah, we can still cut. And David Teal and their own legislative meetings in the past two sessions were telling them the truth in a very easy to understand model. So if Larry's suggestion of KFAR is doable, there is a group in the area that could be reached that way. I like your idea of statewide as well, because clearly the Bush has a greater dependence on the and is in extremely resistant to meddling with the dividends. But statewide is necessary too, because this is a serious crisis, as many have said, and was a serious crisis a year and a half ago.
Well, we have reached 10 o'clock, and I can't just deeply express enough my thanks for Steve. This has absolutely been fabulous. But wait, there's more. We have to get a statement of release from each of you who have asked a question. Unfortunately, that's your punishment for asking
a question. We have to use our real name.
No. Thank you all.